the Buddha in his wisdom offers us these reflections, as he says, for frequent contemplation. We should reflect often on these basic truths of our human experience, our existence as human beings. As human beings, we are subject to impermanence. These bodies are subject to impermanence. They're subject, our bodies, each of us, we're asked to reflect, is subject to aging, illness, death, and separation. We'll be separated from all that's dear and appealing to us, including all beings who are dear and appealing to us. This is the way that it is in this life. And this inherent condition of life, is to some extent fraught. It's difficult, it's challenging, right? It has a dukkha or unsatisfactory quality, life itself, due to its impermanence. The body has an inherently unsatisfactory quality to it, in that it's subject to illness and aging and, of course, death. So we're asked to reflect, to develop this understanding, which is so hard for us, right? So hard for us. We talked about this in great detail in our in-person class this past Monday night, the challenge of this reflection. I talked about having worked on this and done this reflection for many, many years, and there's still, you know, this barrier to really taking it in. There's still this objection in the mind. It's not as strong as it was, but it's still there. So you have to really make an effort to develop this understanding. And the way that we make this effort is by reflecting, by reflecting, by reflecting, by reflecting, repeated reflection. So that the understanding, you know, and the reflection, of course, it's not intellectual. It's something that we come to know. We come to know this truth. You know, all of the Buddha's teachings are pragmatic. They're meant to be pragmatic. So the Buddha's teaching on the impermanence of life, the passing of time, the truth of death, is meant to be more than an idea that we're asked to understand or to consider. It's more than an idea. It's more than an idea. It's not an intellectual construct. It is. It begins with that. We're asked to transcend that state in which it's just an idea. These truths are meant to be more than ideas or concepts. This truth, this understanding of the passing of time and of death in our practice becomes an essential component of the narrative of our lives. So this is how I like to think about it. These understandings become an essential component of the narrative of our lives. They're not just ideas that we think about every once in a while and then put in a neat compartment, you know, like the pots and pans after we cook our dinner. We put them in a neat compartment in the kitchen cabinet. We forget about them until the next day or the next time that we need to use that pot or pan to cook something. These understandings, this understanding of the passing of time and the truth of death, is an understanding that informs how we live as Dharma students from day to day. It's integral to the narrative of our lives. We live our lives with this understanding that we're going to die, that I'm going to die. You know, this is where I'm going. You know, this is where I'm going. Just like you might have a narrative for this day, you know, you're going to the park or you're going to the movies. You know, the great narrative of our lives that we're asked to develop and and to allow it to inform our lives. The great narrative is, you know, I'm going to die. This is where I'm going. This is where I'm going. How am I going to get there? How am I going to get there? How am I going to live as I make my way towards this final destination? You know, this is what informed the narrative of the Buddha's life. You know, he had a certain kind of life as a prince where he was shielded, you know, in very much the same way that we shield ourselves from the truth of illness, aging, and death. One day, you know, as the story says, he came to realize that these were elemental aspects of human existence, sickness, aging, and death. And he began to say, you know, question the way that he was living, and he asked, well, if I'm going to die, how am I going to live? And he came to see that the way he was living, as he said, was not fitting, given that he was going to die. So in the Buddhist teachings, as I talked about on Monday night, you know, in the sutta where he offers this reflection, which I've put in your notes, the Buddha begins by asking us to reflect on the truth of our existence. I am subject to illness, aging, death, and separation. And of course he asks that, you know, that and those understandings inform the narrative of our lives. But then he tells us that we shouldn't just reflect on the fact that we are subject to illness, aging, death, and separation. We should reflect and understand and take to heart the truth that all beings are subject to impermanence. All beings are subject to the passing of time and to death. So it's not just about us. It's not just about us. We're asked to look out beyond ourselves and see this and to understand this. To understand this, to make this an essential component of the way that we consider our human experience. Not just that I'm going to die, but that all beings are going to die, and all beings are subject to the passing of time. So I find it really useful as I go through my days, you know, and, you know, again, when we reflect, you know, we find suitable moments, opportune moments, what they sometimes call an education, teachable moments, right? You find moments to make this kind of a reflection. So sometimes I'll be on a train, you know, and I'll just look around myself and I'll say, you know, all these beings are subject to aging and to illness. All these beings will die. All these beings are experiencing this same pain that's inherent to the human experience that I'm experiencing. You know, or you're waiting online in the supermarket, you know. Just look around you, you know. Just for a moment, consider that all these beings that you're seeing here are subject to sickness, aging, and death, and separation. Some of the most profound experiences I've had in following the Buddha's teachings have been doing just this. You know, times when I've been sitting on a train or on the New York City subway and have just looked and have just seen, you know, it really requires looking and seeing. Looking and seeing, and I've looked and I've seen, and, you know, there's been that understanding, you know, that sort of transcends just an intellectual understanding, that understanding in the heart, you know, that all these beings will die. All these beings, like myself, are subject to the passing of time and the pain of this human experience, existence. You know, Albert Camus talked about the importance in looking into the faces of others, and how that in our technological society, you know, that's been degraded. You know, and of course he was talking about this in the 40s and 50s. A lot of what he was responding to was the telephone, you know, which of course I have my issues with, as most of you know. But, you know, think about how, you know, our habit of looking into the faces of others, into the eyes of others, really seeing others, you know, is degraded in this modern world. It doesn't have to be that way, right? It doesn't have to be that way. It's really the reason why, you know, and thank God for Zoom, you know, that we're able to be able to see each other. It's one of the reasons why I'm kind of a little bit of a stickler for keeping the camera on, if at all possible. Because you know, we need to look, you know, albeit, you know, in the online mode, you know, we need to look into the faces of others. We need to develop this understanding. Each one of these beings, these 26 beings who is here right now, is subject to illness and aging and death. Each one of these beings will die, will be here for a while, just a while, and then will be gone. So we all experience the passing of time and death. We all experience pain in this life, the pain of existence, the mental pain, much of it that comes from our clinging, much of it that comes from, you know, the aversion that we have given that things pass, and the desire to want to hold on to things that pass. So this understanding that all beings in this life are subject to illness, aging, and death is an understanding that we're asked to develop, and an understanding that as Dharma students also informs the narrative of our lives. You know, as Dharma students, you know, these understandings inform the narrative of our lives. You know, the understanding that I'll die, the understanding that all beings will die, will experience sickness, aging, death, and separation. So we're all in it together in this life. You know, we're all in it together. Can we be there for each other? Can we be there for each other? So this experience, this journey to our death, you know, it's a difficult journey. We often talk about this. You know, Dharma students are famous for talking about, you know, the difficulty of life. How many Dharma talks have I given with that theme? Life is hard. I have a whole suit of Dharma talks. Life is hard. Life is difficult. This journey. You know, I mean, life is hard. We you know, I mean, these basic elemental truths of life. We're going to get sick, age, and die. We're going to be separated from all that's dear and appealing to us. It's difficult. As members of Dharma community, we're asked to be there for each other as we make our way in this life, as we meet these inherent difficulties of life. This is what it means to be a member of a Dharma community. We meet this experience of existence together, the challenge of existence, we meet it together using the skills that we've learned. Using the skills that we learn here, we're able to be here for each other in meeting the experience of life, the pain and suffering that's inherent in life, that's inherent in sickness, aging, and death. Together, we meet life, you know, with the heart. Together, we know we can know happiness of heart. There's that well-known passage in the canon where the Buddha says that community with others is all of the holy life. Many of us are familiar with that interchange where Ananda, in a moment of insight, says to the Buddha, "I just realized community with others is half of the holy life." And the Buddha chastens Ananda and says, "No, community with others is all of the holy life." community with admirable beings is all of the holy life. You know, there isn't, you know, and I think in part what he's telling us here is that, you know, there isn't a holy life without this community with others. There isn't this holy life without this community with others. This community with others, being there for others and sharing this journey together, is integral to this holy life. It's essential to this life in which, you know, we think of a holy life, we're learning to meet the experience of life with wisdom and compassion and love, and to meet these difficulties and make the most of life. So the holy life is lived by its definition, the Buddha says, with others, not in isolation, not in isolation. You know, we take time for seclusion, but, you know, that just supports us in being able to live this holy life with others. It's a shared experience. Life is a shared experience. So the holy life includes not just what we do in the service of getting our act together, it includes what we do together and for each other. And of course, you know, we, as we often say, you know, we can't do it alone. You know, we need each other. The term that I've been thinking about a lot, that, you know, I haven't used much, and you maybe don't hear it so much used in Dharma, in the Dharma circles, is solidarity. You know, our path really depends on solidarity. You know, we're in it together and we have to be there for each other. We pull together in the same common cause, which is, as Dharma students, you know, meeting the experience of life, which includes sickness, aging, death, and separation. So we stick together. We stick together. There's this solidarity that's essential to this path. One of my favorite poems of Whitman's is the Song of the Open Road. I'll just read one little stanza from it. Whitman came up with this word, it's kind of a curious term for friend, camarado. And this, the verse begins, camarado, I give you my, that would be like my sangha member, my community member. Camarado, I give you my hand, I give you my love, more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live? You know, we tend to kind of forget about the part with more precious than money. You know, I give you myself before preaching or law. You know, we put a lot of emphasis in the Dharma on the preaching, you know, or the, you know, the principles. You know. But, you know, in the end, what's really important is just being there for each other. Being there for each other. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live? One of the reasons why, you know, this passage, the community is all of the holy life, and the interchange between the Buddha and Ananda has become so popular, I think, and rightly so, is that, you know, Ananda underestimates, you know, the importance of being there for each other. You know, he doesn't perceive, you know, the nature of solidarity, the importance of solidarity in the path. And, you know, it's such an important teaching, you know, in part because of what the Buddha said, but, you know, in part because, you know, we're like Ananda, right? You know, I mean, I love Ananda, you know, because Ananda is sort of like us, you know, he's sort of like us, and the Buddha often has to correct him, you know, in their interplay. And guide him along. But, you know, when he points out Ananda's misunderstandings, in large degree, he's pointing out the misunderstandings that most of us have as human beings. You know, we're seeking to transcend our misunderstandings and understanding and learn to understand what is meaningful in this life and what we need to do to make the most of this life. But we, so there's sort of this gap that sort of Ananda represents. You know, and of course our tendency is to be in it for ourselves, right? To be in it for ourselves. You know, the Buddha, as many of you know, his story, when he achieved full awakening, the bliss of enlightenment, you know, had a decision to make. You know, it's well documented how he contemplated the decision that he had to make. Should I just simply experience the bliss of awakening? Should I just enjoy the happiness of concentration and wisdom and freedom? Or should I engage with others and teach the Dharma? Should I do something else? And of course he decided, you know, he really decided he would do both, right? But he decided to teach. He decided to be there for others. He decided that, you know, the path wouldn't come to fruition, you know, if he simply enjoyed the bliss of awakening. That the path, in order to be a true path, had to include being there for others. It wasn't enough just to know the bliss of awakening. Others were suffering. How could he sit on his cushion and know the bliss of awakening when he did, all he had to do was look out and see that others were suffering? He wanted to be there for others. His heart understood the suffering of his others. You know, when the heart understands the suffering of others, that all beings are subject to sickness, aging, and death and separation, you know, we're able to be there for others. We give. You know, the heart, in its sure release, expresses itself generously. We demonstrate compassion for others. This is what it means to be free from the afflictions on the heart. You know, it's an opportunity for us to be fully generous and compassionate and to be there for others. Buddha realized that. So he set out to teach, and it's again well documented that the first thing that he did was he started a community. He called that community of monks and nuns a sangha. Gradually he included lay people. I always like to make that distinction, you know, it's one that's not made much, but you know, sangha really means the community of monks and nuns. It's not the community of lay people. You know, it's one of those terms, sometimes terms I'm okay with, you know, cross-referencing them and co-opting them for my, you know, contemporary purposes. Sangha, you know, that's a term that really I like to reserve for monks and nuns, the community of monks and nuns. But the Buddha's full community included laymen and lay people. So it was the first thing that he did, was he started community. He understood that community was essential to the holy life, that it was all of the holy life, that if he was going to teach beings to make the most of their human existence, which included sickness, aging, and death, they had to stick together. There had to be this quality of solidarity. So as a good community member, we're here for each other, not just for each other, not just for ourselves. We're here for each other, not just for ourselves. We come to this group, not just for ourselves, but for each other. I mean, this is something that I've talked about so much over the years. You know, we show up for each other. And we embody the elements of goodness. You know, that the path describes for us. You know? So as a good community member, as a Dharma student, there's certain elements of goodness that we seek to develop and to demonstrate. It all begins with these three elements of merit: our generosity, our virtue, our ethical conduct, how we follow the precepts, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in illicit sex, not to lie, and not to take intoxicants that cause us to be heedless. So these elements of goodness, generosity, ethical conduct, and the third element of goodness, our effort. You know, as a community member, a Dharma student, a member of a Dharma community, we're making an effort to train the mind, to abandon what's unskillful, that which is informed by aversion and desire, and to cultivate that which is skillful, that which is informed by love and compassion. We're making that effort. This is what we ask of Dharma students. Nobody's perfect, God knows, not even teachers, other than the Buddha. Nobody's perfect, but we're making an effort. That's what we ask. That's our responsibility, to practice generosity. It's our responsibility as Dharma students and members of the community to practice generosity, ethical conduct, to practice non-harming, and to make an effort, to abandon the unskillful and cultivate the skillful. Developed in these qualities, we're able to be there for each other. So I would hope that we've all had experiences in our lives of solidarity, of being a part of that profound state of solidarity. We may know what it is to be there for each other, to help each other, to support, to love each other. You know, I've been very, very fortunate, and in my own life, to even before or as I came to the Dharma, to have had experiences in my life of solidarity, of community, that were very profound experiences in which I was part of a group in which we all pulled together and took care of each other. One of the ones which I've often talked about is when I played soccer or football, as my European friends would say, in my school days, and really understood what it was to be there for each other and to pull for each other and to love each other and care for each other. You know, my brothers that I played soccer with for all those years in high school, and then of course the guys I played with in college, it was a profound and deep experience. I've always had a very deep spiritual experience of being there for one another and caring for one another and working together, day in and day out on that soccer field. Really learned what it was to be able to be there for other beings and what it was like when other beings were there for me. Camus, the aforementioned Camus, had the exact same experience as a football player, a soccer player, in his days as a youth in Algeria. There's a famous quote from Camus in which he says, "After many years in which the world has afforded me many experiences, what I know most surely in the long run about morality and the obligations of men, I owe to football. What I know most surely in the long run about morality and the obligations of men, I owe to football." The other very profound experience I've had in my life, in addition, of course, to being in a Dharma community, is as a member of 12-step program, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, where I really learned, the profound nature of solidarity in being in a group of other beings in which we relied on each other and were there for each other and took care of each other. And we're able to overcome, our addictions, through this community effort. Really learned what it was to have other people in my camp and relying and what it was to rely on them, and also how to be there for others, how to be there for others. And learned, you know, the blessing of community. And I really learned, you know, I think, you know, still am learning in my time, you know, in AA, that, you know, and I always say this, you know, this is like, you know, sort of my, you know, you get to be somebody with 30 plus years in sobriety, you know, you sort of have your pitch, you know. Mine is like, I don't do anything by myself. I don't do anything by myself in this life. I rely on others, you know. I rely on others, not so much for their advice necessarily, but for their support and their care and their love. You know, I don't do anything alone, and I don't have to do anything alone. None of us has to do anything alone. As they say in AA, we'll love you until you learn to love yourself. You know? And so as a Dharma teacher, you know, as a leader of Dharma communities, you know, my charge I see is to teach skills. What I teach is pragmatic, as the Buddha says it should be, to teach skills and to establish and lead community, to form some kind of solidarity so that we can have this experience of solidarity, so that we can pull each other through, so that we can be there for each other as we meet the experience of life, as we meet sickness, aging, death, and separation. So in a Dharma group, the way I see it, you know, there's really two elements to a Dharma group. We learn skills, and we're here for each other. We're here for each other in this experience of life in which we'll know illness, aging, and death. We're here for each other so that we can go through these experiences of life together. So a Dharma group doesn't cohere around the worship of a particular being, a god, or adherence to a belief system. It's just about being here for each other as we meet the pain and suffering that's inherent in life. That's what a Dharma group is about. Being here for each other as we meet the pain and suffering of life. So this group, this Sunday meditation group, which has been such a blessing, began at the outset of the pandemic as a place to come together, to be there for each other as we were meeting this very difficult experience of life, illness and death that, you know, we were all experiencing. That was the, you know, the genesis of this group, a place to be there for, where we could be there for each other. Thank God we had Zoom where we could meet and be here for each other. So, you know, I've always tried, you know, and that was a real challenge for me, you know, in Zoom, can we do this? Can we have a group on Zoom? You know, that's why I try to keep groups small. I mean, that's how the Buddha really taught, you know, it was always grassroots, try to keep groups small so that we know each other, so that to some extent we know each other's faces. You know, there's people here that I've known for many, many years, and it means so much, you know. I know Heather more than 25 years, Steve, you know, all these beings who are here, Stephen, Connie, you know. But all of you I've known, you know, and it's a blessing just to see everybody's face and to be here for each other and know that, you know, we can go through these things that are difficult together. Downtown Meditation Community, you know, as I've talked about before, I began, you know, in the days and weeks and months after 9/11. You know? And, you know, remember, I've talked about this before, you know, walking outside of the Tibet House where I was teaching a beginner's class, which I think, Connie, you were in, and walking down the street, I could smell, you know, in the days after 9/11, I could smell the burning of the bodies, the dead bodies. And, you know, and it just sort of hit me, you know, it's like, I'm going to start a group, you know, and that became Downtown Meditation Community. You know, this notion of solidarity, we sometimes see in times of great strife and difficulty. You know, we saw this, you know, on the streets of New York, you know, on September 11th, you know, people being there for each other in a profound way, you know, in a way that they normally weren't, you know, those moments, you know, when we just let go of our liking and disliking, when we let go of our thinking, you know, we experience the heart's sure release. This person is suffering. We're all in this together. These buildings are coming down. I'm going to help my brother and my sister. Yeah. So in Dharma communities, we're learning to open the heart, you know, and to develop the heart, and in turn to be there for each other as we go through this life. Life is difficult. As the Buddha teaches, there's illness, aging, death, and separation. You know, in his first sermon, as he set out to teach, you know, he delineated the difficulties of life. You think I'm tough. You know, in his first sermon, Ajahn Jeff uses the word stressful for suffering, or conducive to suffering. Actually, stressful fits well here. You know, it's, when he uses the word stressful, it means it conduces to suffering. It's difficult. It can lead to clinging and suffering. His first sermon, he said, birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from the loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. Experiences of body and mind. It's difficult. Life presents us with difficulty and challenges. It's difficult for all of us, and this is what we're asked to understand, that we're all going through this together. We're all in this thing together, and we need each other if we're going to make it through. So it's something to think about. You know, I often suggest that we reflect each week. You know, what is solidarity? What does it mean to me? What does it mean to us? Do we understand the pain and suffering of others, all beings, in terms of their existence as beings who will experience illness, aging, death, and separation? What would it mean for us to be there for others? So let's just close our eyes for a second.